The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Jerry Blavitt, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to see so many of you guys that I see occasionally. Let's have a big hand for Charlie Rose, ladies and gentlemen. A big hand for Charlie Rose. Love you and your wine.
So we're here to talk about this book, You Only Rock Once. I have the galley. We have real good copies upstairs for sale. And the first thing that the Geeters fans know this, but a lot of people who are sort of casual listeners maybe don't, is that the start comes with the American Bandstand that some think was the real American Bandstand with Bob Horn. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, in the book I talk about the fact that, you know, I came from a neighborhood, South Philadelphia, and I came from a broken family because my father was Jewish and my mother was Italian. And they ran away and got married, and to marry out of your religion at that time, and you must understand, South Philly, the Jewish people lived at 7th Street, Jackson, Porter Street. The Irish and the Polish lived on 2nd Street, Front Street. And the Italians lived in that Italian pocket, okay? And when they ran away, it was very traumatic for my mom, because my father really didn't have a full-time job. Of course, later on, he through political connections, he wound up working for the railroad only to get the benefits back then. And there was a guy called Bill Barrett, who A.D. Amoroso might remember, that was a big politician. And politically in South Philly, you used to be able to do things. So I grew up in that environment, and there was always a resentment on the Italian side. And I used to see all my cousins, and the only one that really was very kind to me is my Aunt Mim, who is still alive today. She's 90 years old, and I went to see her the other day. And so I grew up in that type of an environment, and my mother became a riveter because my father was never around. And after my sister Roberta was born, then he came out. And those days when you went to jail for bookmaking, you were there maybe a week or 2 weeks. I mean, it was like, it wasn't like what happens today, you know. But he always hung around in the Jewish neighborhoods, okay? And I was raised by the nuns. And it really, as a kid, it was lonely, because during the summertime, when I'd have to go home early, my cousins were all at my grandmother's house, because my grandmother fed everybody. And my mother said, come on, we got to go home, we got to go to sleep. And it was like, but Mom, like, you know, it's 6 o'clock at night. And my cousins were going out and playing in the street. My mother said, no, you got to be, tomorrow morning, you got to be up at six, you got to be at St. Monica's. So I grew up in that type of thing, and I used to love Indians. I used to listen to radio, and the reason that I loved the Native American Indian, because they had that freedom, they had that spirit, and I used to get the comic books, and I used to listen to a radio show called Straight Arrow, you know, Kaniwa Fury, and this was a Comanche white man who was Comanche, who lived on a ranch, but whenever there was an injustice for the white man or the Indian, he would come out of the cave on this magnificent palomino and say, Kaniwa Fury, and it was sponsored by Nabisco. N-A-B-I-S-C-O, Nabisco is the name to know. So I would listen to this, and I felt happiness. Yeah. And I'd go to day nursery school. We'd come back. My grandmother would feed us, and that was the ritual. My grandfather, who really was a tough guy, was in the ice business and coal business. And eventually, my father put them in the business with more trucks. But eventually, being the guy he was, he wound up not giving them the money. He was keeping the money. And there was a friction between the Italian side and the Jewish side. And my father, see, there's one thing about the Italians and the Jews, which I loved. The Italians were workers. You know, the Jewish guys, they were dressed with suits and ties and Hamburgs, and they would be drinking scotch, you know, and they would go to a little Jewish restaurant called Leibowitz's, which was on McKean Street, you know, and when they made a score, everybody. So it was different things.
Cultural.
It was an amazing cultural thing for me. And I always felt that sadness, though, because I didn't have really a father.
Yeah, you were sort of in between worlds.
Yeah. So one day, my Uncle Jimmy is singing with a group, and they are going to appear on Bandstand, Bob Horn's Bandstand, in 1953. Now, I never saw Bandstand, but it was mandatory for my aunts and my uncles and nephews to be in front of this TV set at 1534 McKean Street to watch our uncle sing. Well, when I saw that show and these kids dancing, I said, wow, I got to do that. Because in the Italian family, we always danced. I mean, when I was with the Holidays, we'd be dancing New Year's Eve. They'd be shooting guns in the street. You'd be doing the mummer strut, the beep, bop, bop, bop. So when I saw these kids dancing, I said out loud, man, I can dance like that. And the Italians looked at me, manga parada di niente, don't open your mouth. And I said, whoop. But my Aunt Mim looked at me, beautiful Irish woman, and smiled. And I looked at her and I said, she believes that I'm going to dance. So at that time, I just became a freshman, okay, at Newman. And Bishop Newman at that time was Southeast Catholic. And what happened was that they were on 13th and Jackson. So a couple of my buddies as freshmen, and I weighed the same as I weigh now, 126, 127. Hey, let's go up to this place called Bandstand. I was 13 years of age. So we went up Broad Street, bop, bop, got onto the L, bop, bop. And there was a line. And you had to have a card or proof that you were 14 years of age. So I said, wait, let's go. And I watched as the guys, the cameramen, were coming out the side. They were coming out the side on Market Street. So I said, come on. We snuck in, and we went on, and I went on Bandstand. I started to dance.
Had you danced at all in,
yeah, I used to dance in front of your family? My mother was the greatest dancer. See, when you were a kid, to dance, you would stand outside and for the trolley car. It would be a pole, and you would hold a pole. And that's how you learned how to dance. So I danced constantly. So I went, and they had a dance contest. I got into the dance contest, and it was like for 4 weeks, elimination. I went every week, every week, every week, every week. Well, I wind up winning the dance contest, and Tony Mamarella says to Bob, Is he 14 years of age? So Horn calls me in the office. He says, listen, are you 14? He said, you're not going to lie to me. I said, no, I'm not going to lie. I said, I'm 13. He said, how'd you get in? I said, I snuck in. And Big Jack was the door guy. So he called Big Jack. He said, how'd this guy get in? Jack said, he must, but he's been here every week. So he gives me a committee card where I'm now a committee member. And they have another dance contest. And all of a sudden, I'm getting fan mail. I never had anything like this in my life, man. Okay? Bob Horn says to me, they have the second dance contest. I win the second dance contest. And I get a tuxedo. They gave me a cockamamie tuxedo from Duskers, which was too big for me. I sold the tuxedo. I gave it to somebody. Okay? So Horn says to me, look, you can't get in the dance contest anymore, but I would like you to be the head of the dance committee. Your duties would be get here at 3 o'clock. Now, remember, we got out of school at 2:15. Get here at 3. Come to my office. You will greet the artists that are here. Also, I want you to listen to the records we have. Yeah. And I want you to pick me out records that we could do Rate the Record on. So I got there early, and I would listen to the record. And all of a sudden, Bob said, the promotion man just gave me the new Pat Boone record. And I said, Tutti Frutti. I said, Bob,
that
are you
ain't
crazy?
Pretty.
I said, are you crazy? So what's wrong? I said, do you ever hear the original on Imperial by Fats Domino? Yeah. He said, no. He said, the promotion men are only giving me the songs that they want me to play. Yeah. I said, I'm going to get you the original. I used to go to Sunray drugstores, and they used to have these bins and bins of records, and I'd spend hours getting these records. So all of a sudden, Bob Horn is playing Tutti Frutti by Little Richard. He's playing Silhouettes by the Rays. Yeah. He's not doing it by the Crew Cuts, who also cut it. He's playing Shaboom by the Chords. Yeah. And all of a sudden, Bandstand is the hippest show on TV. And all the artists are watching this little cockamamie kid, matchstick, dancing. And one day, Bob says to me, listen, there's going to be a fellow that's doing a show. In the book, you'll see pictures of Ramar of the Jungle with me. I mean, I'm John Hall. He had Robbie Q. Lewis. I mean, he had Phil Silvers. Yeah. So beside having artists, there were people who were in town. It was important for them to do promotions on Bandstand. So he says, there's a guy in town at the Schubert doing a show called Mr. Wonderful. His name is Sammy Davis, okay? When he comes, you take care of him. And I'll tell you a great story about Johnny Ray, because Bandstand had a promotion. Bob Horn got a Lion Club, okay? And he had it, and the contest was the name the Lion Cub on television. But this Lion Cub would be in Bob Horn's office covered in a little cage. And it only come uncovered when you put him on Bandstand, and then they cover the thing. Johnny Ray comes in. I never forget this. Johnny Ray's meticulous. He's got a beautiful cashmere Chesterfield coat on. So he comes in, and I greet him, and Bob's getting ready to do the show, and he says to Bob, what's in there? Bob says, John, don't go near it. It's a Lion Cub. Oh, you're kidding. He says, can I peek? Bob says, don't, John. Oh, it won't bother me. He lifts the thing up, and the lion, little Lion Cub, as soon as he goes in to pet it, the lion, there goes his whole cashmere coat. Johnny Ray screaming and yelling, and he fainted. Fortunately, the coat got shredded and not his arm. I don't know if I tell you in that one, but anyway, so Sammy. So I'm jitterbugging, and I go to get Sammy, and he's watching in the studio, the monitor. So I say, okay, Mr. Davis, now when Bob Horn says we have company, you have to stand right over there, okay? And he'll say, we have company. So he says, psst, I want to ask you a question. I say, yeah, what? Where did you learn to dance like that? I said, man, everybody in South Philadelphia dances. I said, we want to try and impress the girls. You know, we want to go on a date. He said, man, he said, you're like a little white me. I said to myself, no, man. And from that moment on, he invited me to go see him at the Schubert. And every time he was in town at the old Latin Casino, I would go see him. And we became lifelong friends. And in the book, you will see great pictures of Sammy when I did the discophonic TV scene. And sadly enough, I was with him May the 16th when he passed away. And there's also a very interesting in the book about that passing. Jerry Lewis went to see Sammy. And I used to fly back and forth to the West Coast because in 1990, I had melanoma. And that's also in the book how that happened. It's August the 15th. If you're Catholic, that's the Feast of the Assumption. That's a holy day of obligation. And Victor Potamkin, a dear friend of mine, called me up and says to me, I'm having dinner with George Burns. Why don't you come up? And Dr. Norman Orentrek. Dr. Norman Orentrek was the most famous dermatologist. He developed the transplants for all of the actors, famous guy. I said, Vic, I'm on Peter Gold Radio, WPGR. I don't get done till 6 o'clock. I wear my hat like this. I wear the headphones. I'm not even going to be dressed. He said, come on. I said, nah, forget it. Didn't realize that August the 15th, which was a Wednesday, I would go to a mass, 12:15 mass at St. Joe's, and I would get dressed. So I said, hold it. Yeah, okay. I called Vic. I said, is the invite still there? Yeah, come on up. He said, I'll have my driver pick you up at Pennsylvania Station. I got done doing the show, City Line Avenue, shoot it over. I think it was like a 6:35 train up to New York. We're at the 21 Club where we were. And it's dimly lit. And I would wear my watch on this wrist. And I had a booking to get back on the last train to Philly, 11 o'clock. So we're laughing, and George Burns has got a cigar. You know, he's like 80-some years old, and bop, bop, bop. So I take my watch off, and I'm blind, okay? And I do this. I go like this, and Norm Orentrek says to me, let me see that. So I give him the watch. He says, no, no, no. He said, how long have you had that? I said, Doc, I don't know. I got them all over my body. We call them beauty marks in South Philadelphia, you know? He says, I want you in my office tomorrow morning at 7. I said, Doc, I got to be back on the rail. I'm leaving at 11 o'clock. George Burns says, schmuck.
I've been trying to see this guy for 6 months. He's not going to see me. He's going to see you?
Victor Potemkin says, George, at your age, don't worry about seeing a doctor. And that's how he discovered the melanoma. But it happened at the same time that Sammy, and it's funny because Sammy was doing the show with Frank and Liza. And it was during the Super Bowl, January that year, where the Super Bowl was in Florida. And we all stayed at the Coconut Grove. I stayed with Sammy. Barbara was with Frank. Liza, at that time, was married to Peter Gennaro.
Oh.
Mark Gennaro, who was the sculptor, okay? And Sammy was coughing, spitting up blood. So in the dressing room, I said, Sam, what's wrong? He said, I don't know. He said, but I'm going for a complete physical. I've got one more engagement to do with Harris, Bill Harrod and Reno's, okay? So, okay, I said, Sam, you know, I got a little thing over here. Yeah, bubby, bub, bub. To make a long story short, he was diagnosed with throat cancer. We both, same time, except I beat it. And I was born, when you read the book, you'll be just amazed some of the things that I've gone through in my lifetime. But I used to fly out on a Sunday to Cedars in Mount Sinai in L.A.
Yeah.
I would leave at 7-something in the morning, get to L.A., okay, spend 2 hours with Sammy, and it was the cutest thing. They gave him a suit. I don't know if you know. It was a lead suit, and he was in a lead suit, and they had a little hole where they would with the radiation. And I would spend, and I would go back to Philly. I would do this maybe twice a month. To make a long story short, he beat it. He was clean. He did a movie called Taps with Gregory Hines, okay? It was a great movie. And I'll tell you, in the book, there's a story about me meeting Etta James. Because Etta James had a song, I don't want no bop, and I loved Etta James. So she's in the movie, you know? So anyway, Sammy says to me, I beat it, but I got to go to Chicago to do a Christmas movie with Eddie Murphy. It's the last movie he ever did. He says, do me a favor. The premiere of Taps is going to be in New York City. I want you to take Altavis, and Liza is going to take Halston, okay? So I represented Sammy at the movie. And on the screen comes Etta James. And the after party is at Roseland. And who's there? Etta James live doing the song. I mean, it was a stellar night, you know. And Etta, by the way, is not in good health. She's not in good health, diabetes and things like that. So Sammy goes to Chicago, catches a cold in Chicago, and had dental work done. And I think Trudy Haynes, who goes back with me with Sinatra, let's have a big hand for Trudy Haynes, ladies and gentlemen. One of the true pioneers in TV.
Yeah.
She met Sammy with me. We did things with Frank together. At any rate, Sammy developed cancer all over again. Mm. And it was very, very bad. Comatose, Jerry Lewis goes to see him. And Jerry Lewis comes out of the house crying. My friend Sammy's dying. He only weighs 93 pounds. And the press converged on that house, Benedict Canyon, Summit Drive. You couldn't get in or out. I mean, they were all waiting. It was like a death watch. I get a call from Shirley Rose, and she says, Geeter, if you want to see your friend alive, come on out. He's not going to make it for the weekend. He passed away on a Wednesday, May the 16th. I flew out on a Friday morning, but I lived at that time next to Cardinal Kroll.
Yeah,
and he was my neighbor. Okay, one of my daughters is here, Geraldine. Geraldine, turn around, stand up and take a bow. That's my little daughter right over there. One of my Geeterettes.
Yeah.
So I go out, and I say to the Cardinal, can you get me holy water? And he gave me a little thing of holy water from Lourdes, which is the miracle. I got out there Friday, went to the house, instructed how to go. Bo, who was Sammy's bodyguard, met me, went through the garage. And Sammy's office was converted into where he was staying, okay? Not in the house, which was part of the house. And he was comatose. He was off all life support. The heart thing was beating. And the thing that struck me with cancer, they had a spritzer in this room, and they had a male nurse who would take the bandage off and rewrap it because it was eating, and the stench from that. But this spritzer with flour, a flowery smell, like every 2 seconds, they put the holy water when he would do a wrapping again. Sammy, who was supposed to die that weekend, lasted Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. I had to get back to do the thrill show on a Thursday night. The doctors said, this is amazing. He's off all life support. But his heart was so strong that if Sammy didn't smoke and drink and abuse himself with substances, his dad died at 98 years old. Wow. His mom just passed away, babe, maybe about 6 years ago. She was 101 years old. So Sammy had a long lifeline. So I said, look, I got to leave tomorrow, Wednesday. I got to do the thrill show, but I'll come back. And I'll tell you, my Brit came, and lovely woman. My Brit was Sammy's second wife. And Tracy was there, and Mark was there. And Bobby Darin's manager was also there. Bobby Darin, Sammy loved Bobby Darin. And Robert Blake, Beretta, I will never forget, would come in crying and talking in Sammy's ear. Sammy, maybe he heard, Sammy didn't move. You can't leave me, you can't leave me. We actually had to pull Robert Blake away. Wow. I mean, he was Sinatra. Frank came in, went up to the room, and just walked out. Said nothing. Liza came in, cried, and they all left. I was there with his mom and his family, and I would send out food from Brentwood, an Italian restaurant out there in Brentwood, and I feed him. So I went back to the Beverly Hills Hotel saying, I'm getting out of here tomorrow, and I'll come back Friday. I get up to take an early flight early in the morning, and I go to the house, and I go through the garage. And everybody's sleeping. And there's Sammy, and I noticed that nothing is moving. Mm. And the urine bottle, nothing. I shake out the beast. I said, out the beast, Sammy's passed. Everybody got up. It was like expected. It was very eerie. Everybody got up, you know, and Shirley Rose was there, and his mom was there. And they said to me, how are we going to get the body out of here without anybody knowing that Sammy's passed? And every day they would have these flower trucks coming, bringing him flowers from all over. I said, I got an idea. Shirley, call up the company. Tell them to bring an empty flower truck that we want to get all these flowers out. Good idea. 9 o'clock in the morning, the flower truck comes, pulls up right in the back into the garage. We take Sammy's body, which was, and in L.A., it was, he had the death certificate signed already because they knew he was going to die. Zipped him up, me, Bobby Darin's manager, and it's funny, it's sad because his name was Stan Blythe at that time. He had a hernia, and it's funny, he had a difficult time. So I really,
93-pound man.
Yeah, but Sammy even was heavy, okay? And we got him into the flower truck. Nobody ever took a picture of Sammy Davis in a pose being dead.
Yeah.
You never saw a picture of that. Yeah. With Frank, unfortunately, with the strolling him in and the hospital and the taking pictures. But my life, I have been blessed. And the reason I wrote this book is because of the fact I, as a street kid, growing up in a neighborhood where you knew everybody. And let me tell you, people ask me about my friendship with Angelo Bruno. He was a person that lived in the neighborhood and was respectful and helped people. My mother and his wife were from the same town in Italy. I knew Ange all of my life. And when I split from my wife, Patty, my daughter is here, I used to take my grandkids, his grandkids and my kids, every Sunday we would take them to dinner, Angelo's grandkids. And then I would drop Angelo's grandkids off on Snyder Avenue. So after I split with Patty, I still took my kids out on Sunday. Every Sunday, we would have dinner. We would go to Frankie Bradley's. We would go to the Medici's. And I was like almost like Art Linkletter, romper room. I had all the kids coming on Sunday. So what happened is When I dropped the kids off, little Mark and little Ralphie, Sue said, you're not, no, I'm not home. Well, where are you going to eat tomorrow night? I was at the Drake Hotel. I said, I'm okay. Ann said, listen, come on, you'll eat over here. You'll come with us. So I became a part of that family.
Yeah.
And his sister Lee and the Maggios, they were wonderful people. And I must tell you something. I grew up, well, you never questioned anybody that was a neighbor. You questioned if somebody came into the neighborhood that you didn't know. Hey, what are you doing here? No, you don't belong here. Get out of here. I'm here to see my aunt. What's her name? Where's she live? Okay, you're okay. So it was a wonderful time. You knew everybody. Of course, when Ange died, and his son said to me, Michael said, look, you've been like a son to my father. And I really was with that family. I would have coffee with him. I would drive him around. I would take him to see if he needed, because he didn't drive. If he had, and I was working at nighttime, so I was free during the daytime. So I would take him up to Jay Cosman's office, and then we'd go back, and Sue would cook scungeal. I used to love scungeal salads, okay? So when he died, I was in Margate. I dropped him off at that time because he had to see his lawyers. He was killed on a Friday, and I dropped him off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I went down to Margate, okay? Good and work. I got a call at 10 o'clock. My dad said, and a police guy from Margate come up and said to my dad, tell the Geeter that his friend Angelo was killed. Now, that was the most, whoever thought that this guy, I mean, who was a gentleman, never, and you got to understand something. For 25 years, there was no problems in Philadelphia. No problems at all in Philadelphia. And in the book, you will read that law enforcement respected him, and there was that unwritten law. Yeah. You can do this, you can't do this. Okay, don't cross the line, don't embarrass us.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that at that, they come, the FBI comes and after he's dead, sends you a message.
What happened?
You to send a message.
Right.
To...
Now, so what happened is when Michael said, please keep the press out. And I knew all the press guys. Trudy can tell. I've been in show business 51 years. So I had to make a decision. Only the people in the neighborhood and the close families knew I was that close with Angelo. Okay? I figured if I'm going to do this, I'm going to be under the scrutiny, not only of the press, on how come this kid is so close to this family that he is keeping the press and law enforcement out. Because I used to see you used to follow Angelo.
Yeah.
So I said, this guy was a friend of mine in life. His family, beautiful family. Okay, I'll do it, Michael. And I kept him out. From that moment on, there were pictures of me on the step, helicopters. What is Jerry Blab at the Geeter? 2 weeks after he passes, I'm having lunch with Phil Testa at the Nostalgia Room and Frankie D'Alfonso because everybody, these were neighbors. They all want the Frank Palumbos, okay? And it's in the book. And I'm having lunch, and the bar is over there, and I see these three guys, big guys, good-looking guys, eye-to-eye contact. And one of them goes like this. So I say that to the guys, I'll be right back. They say, where are you going? I said, I'll be right back. I go over to the bar, and this big guy says, you know who I am? I said, I do, Mr. Best. He said, how do you know who I am? I said, about a year ago, Joel Spivak was doing a TV show every morning on Channel 10, and he had a panel on organized crime. And he invited Mr. Best, who was the head of the FBI at that time in this district, and he invited Jake Cosman, who was Angelo's lawyer and was my friend. I used to take Jake around. And he invited Frank Friel, and Frank Wallace Sr. was the head of organized crime. So Jake calls me and said, listen, well, I want you to take me up to WCAU. I need, he used to call me boy. Boy, take me up to WCAU. So I took Jake Cosman, and I sat in the wings, and I watched the discussion, and that's how I know this guy Edgar Best. So I said to him, I know who you are, and I told him the story. He says, you do know me. He says, well, I'm going to tell you why I called you over. He said, that was a very admirable thing that you did for his family. I want you to know, he also was our friend. And I want you to know, though, that you're going to be under a lot of scrutiny on who and why and where this all came from. I said, thank you. I go back to the table, and it's in the book, and Tester says to me, what that guy want? I said, well, he's just the head of the FBI. I said, the head of the FBI? So what's he want with you? He said, well, he just wanted me to know that I'm going to get a lot of heat. He said, don't worry about it. You'll get used to it. You know? So this has been my life. But what happened after that, I really was under intense scrutiny. I own a club in Margate called Memories in Margate. And all of a sudden, the New Jersey State Police came in on me. They came and raided the club, you know, and they really caused my father to have a heart attack, you know. And what happens, and it's in the book, if you own a liquor license in Jersey, you have to give them whatever they want, and they don't have to have subpoena power because of the fact you own a liquor license. It's a privilege. So I had to give them not only the corporation, my corporation that owned Memories, but my corporation that took care of my show business end, and they would then take all of these records and give them to the feds. Right. And then the feds started an investigation. The IRS started an investigation, and they started to subpoena all of my employees and my bookkeeper. And they went to my wife, God bless her, and I love my wife. I'm not in love with her, but I love her for being the mother of my children, okay? And they went to my wife, and she slammed the door in their face, saying, you know, your husband's been known to fool around. She said, yeah, that's why I got rid of him. And she slammed the door. You know, so this all went on. And what happened is, it's not only about my passion and my dreams, about my music and the freedom that I've had, but it's about growing up in America when you were young, and there was loyalty, and there was respect, and music always kept me whole. Throughout all of this investigation, throughout all of the money that I had to spend to defend myself, I knew in my heart I never did anything wrong. But yet, the state of New Jersey still come on after, and I'll tell you a great story, which is in the book. The guy's name, I call it Les Miserables. You know the guy that stole the loaf of bread? You know, Xavier, and for the rest of his life, they're looking for this poor guy, okay? This one guy, his name is Grant Gazupi. I want this. I want that. I want that. So he calls me in my apartment. He says, I must see you right away. Now, I knew what they were doing because my lawyers, Carmen Asuti, when they would go up with the feds, they would have all of the records. So Carmen would say, they got all the records that you're giving the state of New Jersey there. So he says to me, Grant, he says, there's a liquor bill here without a canceled check. I said, listen, if you would have looked in the Dorchester bill, you see that you have it. You probably lost it. And by the way, Carmen had called me the day before. He said, the feds have dropped the investigation. I said, by the way, all the records that you've been giving to the feds, the IRS, they've concluded that there's no wrongdoing here, and they have dropped their investigation. This guy's face turned white. He ordered a cup of coffee. Okay, so, and I said to the waitress, give me his check. He grabbed my arm. Don't you dare. I said, Grant, I'll see you later on. So it's just, you know, but the thing that's kept me whole, and I got to tell you, my competitors who were never able to touch me because I didn't do format radio. I was not like WIBG. These guys were great voices. My rhythm, my love of the music, it was different than what they did. But the kids knew that, so they're doing 200 kids at a record hop, and I'm doing 2,000 kids at a record hop. But they used that to try and hold me down. I lost a TV show. I was doing, before you had Dancing on Air, Mike, Zee Shubin said to me, we want to develop a five-day-a-week TV show. And they were talking to me about that. As soon as the situation happened, that was the end of it, and my dear friend Mike Nice developed a wonderful dance show called Dancing on Air. And that's how it began. So But here we are. Here we are. I'm right. Living life, and that's it.
So we're going to take some questions in a couple minutes, and I have a couple questions. The first is I want to take you back to Bandstand.
Yeah.
And I want to know about those committee meetings and what were the conversations like with the other dancers. Like, you guys would have had to have some time. Do you remember any of the conversations?
Yeah.
And what did people talk about?
When you're the head of the committee, you have the dancers were committee members. And it was my job to rotate, and they knew that was it. And if they couldn't really beef, because if they went to Tony Mamarello, the producer, Tony would say, no, Jerry, that's Jerry's job to rotate you. Yeah. But it was a family back then. We all got fan mail, and we all went to the dances together. And it's funny, because when you read what happened with Dick Clark, I mean, I went to jail when I was 16 years old, because I picketed Bandstand. We wanted Bob Horn, not Dick Clark. And Dick said to me, look, we'll double your salary. I said, I don't want the money. I was getting $15 a week. We want Bob Horn back. The show went national. These kids became national stars. Dick inherited everything that Bob had, because there was nothing wrong back then in accepting money or publishing. And he had publishing on a song called At the Hop. You could rock it, you can roll it, do the slap. And he was, so I was the road manager, and we went into New York City to do the little theater, the Beach Nut Gum Show. Iffic, remember that? Each Iffic, Saturday, right? And Dick sees me, and I hadn't seen him since I'm picketing him. And he's very cordial. He knows I'm the road manager. He owns the publishing. I go on the show. I stay in New York City. The next day, I'm going back to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania Station. Who's going back to Philadelphia? Dick Clark. He says, come in, sit with me. I'm going to talk to you. I go, holy shoot, okay. So we sit on the train going back. And he says, you know, I have everything that Bob had. He said, you could have been a national star. We offered you more money. And I said, Dick, let me finish. He said, you did something that I will never have. He said, I know if I lose Bandstand, all these people that are around me, the promotion men that are kissing my butt, and all of the, if somebody takes it over, I won't have that. I said, yeah, you'll have my loyalty because you understand what I did. And we have been friends from the very beginning. When other disc jockeys were knocking the heck out of me, Dick Clark would go on American Bandstand and say, boy, do you remember Jerry Blavitt? He just played a song called Sherry. I want to play that. I heard Jerry Blavitt last night when I was driving, and he played He's So Fine by the Chiffons. He became my biggest booster. And he wrote the foreword in this book. And he's not really that well. And I spoke to him about the forward. And I said, Dick, I want you to know one thing. I love you very much, and I don't want you ever fret the train ride. And he said to me, I never have forgotten the train ride, and I want to write the forward. And the forward that he wrote in this book is, and he says, you were a rebellious kid. You know, so.
The rebel jock.
The rebel jock.
I want to ask you about another one of those voices here who I never got to hear, but I understand was a real serious DJ, Jocko Henderson. Tell us about him.
Jocko Henderson, in my opinion, if he were white, could have been bigger than Alan Freed at that time. Jocko had a persona that I developed, and he was another one of my mentors. When all these guys on IBG were knocking the heck out of me, it was the Black Cats who said, hey, man, Geeter, go ahead. Go ahead, man. You got rhythm. You got style. You got soul. And Jocko was like another one in my career that made it happen for me. And, you know, I listened to these guys. I didn't listen to the white radio station. I used to listen to the real deal.
Yeah.
D-A-S-N-H-A-T.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. Do we have someone with a microphone for questions from the audience? Yeah. So let's take some questions.
Hello, Carl Poplar. Here's one of the greatest attorneys right over there, ladies and gentlemen, from New Jersey. Stand up. My man, Carl Poplar, right over there.
Hi.
My man. Listen, it's so wonderful to see so many of you people that have been a part of my life. And I think you'll really enjoy the book because it's the real deal.
Yeah, Zach? Here's one right here.
You're certainly known for rhythm and blues, and as you're saying, H-A-T and D-S. Can you tell us how you got involved with the Monkees?
Oh, that's a funny thing. What happened was I had a record company with Nat Sigel called Crimson Records. And at that time, when we were doing the oldies, I came up with the idea, let's do compilations, because kids were going into the record stores and they couldn't find the songs that I was playing. So I called up the record companies and we put them out in an album. It was called Lost Night Records. Crimson, you might remember Lost Night, and we had the record museums back then, okay? So it was so successful that I had said to Nat Sigel, who was my manager, and Jerry and Jarrett, why don't we now start a record company developing new artists? So we had a company called Crimson. Kenny Gamble, at that time, was with Leon. And we used to have at my home, I had a big home in South Philadelphia, every Monday we would have a mother's club. And we would invite people from the record business to come over, and we'd get hoagies from Larry's, and we'd get steak sandwiches from Gino's, and we'd shoot pool. I had a big home, pool tables. So Kenny Gamble comes over. And there was a group called the Soul Survivors that were working on 13th Street. I said to Kenny, Kenny, we got a brand new label. You got to go see these kids. They're amazing. He goes, he sees them, he records a song called Expressway to Your Heart. I go to Puerto Rico, I put them on my TV show, it becomes a smash locally in Philadelphia. I get a call from Donnie Kirshner, who developed the Monkees. He's the one who says, your show is syndicated, they want you on the Monkees. You know, Jack Nicholson wrote some of the episodes. Did you know that, for the Monkees? And also did the movie on them. Okay? He did that movie on them. The Beatles had what? Help? Hair?
Help.
Right, help. Okay? So, at any rate, I do the Monkees. Donnie says, great. I come back to Philly. He calls me. He says, you got a smash record in Philadelphia called Expressway to Your Heart. I want to buy the master. He left the Monkees Screen Gems and he started his label. And that's how I got with the Monkees, because of Donnie Kirshner.
Yeah. So do you really, in the book you say, you consider the Beatles lightweights where rock and roll's concerned. Let's hear a little bit about
that. This is no disrespect to the Beatles, but you got to understand something. I'm playing rhythm and blues and rock and roll. This is the real deal. When the Beatles came on, She Loves You, yeah, to me that was bubblegum. I want to hold your hand. Now the Stones, boom, 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 boom. They had a deal. So Dolly Banks, the owner of the radio station, says to me, every station is playing the Beatles. Why aren't you playing the Beatles? I said, Dolly, because my audience has not requested me. No, you got to play the Beatles. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will go on the air, and I will play a Beatle record, and I will say to the audience, if you want me to play the Beatles, call me. I knew what the answer was anyway. So I put it on. The phones lit up. Don't ever play that. Don't ever play that. And she left me alone. But later on, when they did the Long and Winding Road, they started to do some really good songs that I had accepted. But I didn't play that stuff. I mean, the early stuff was bubblegum.
Yeah.
Bubblegum. Yeah.
All right. More questions. Don't be shy. Right there.
Jerry, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your time in Camden. You said you were locked in one night. And
Camden,
could you tell that story? I don't know.
What happened is, when I got off the road with Danny and the Juniors, I was a big mahop downtown because I was in show business. Danny the Juniors, Don Rickles, I was his valet. So I went to see my mother. My mother never approved of me marrying Patty because Patty had a previous child and was divorced. And my mother, I guess my mother realized what she went through with my father being Jewish. And she said to me, if you marry this woman, I'm never going to talk to you again. And that weighed very heavily on me. And when I got off the road, and it had been maybe a couple of months since I saw her, I went back to my house on Bancroft Street. And I knocked at the door, and she opened up the door. And I said, Mom. And she looked at me. She said, come on in. And I came in, and she sat down. And we talked. I hugged her. And I knew everything was going to be okay. I felt good. I left the house and I went to 17th and Mifflin, where I grew up. Okay? And on the corner, the guys around the corner were shooting crap. So I felt good. I got into a crap game. All right? And as you're doing the dice, one of the guys is Don Pinto. He owns the Venus Lounge in South Philadelphia. And he's saying, we're doing great, but I'd like to do something on a Monday night. Maybe we could do a radio show. So one of the guys sarcastically said, "Oh, yeah, radio, talk to Blavitt. He knows everything about show business." And I said, yeah. I said, "I tell you what. Okay, you guys are making fun. I could do a radio show. You don't know anything about radio." I said, because I knew I used to promote records. So you go up to the radio station, and you're sitting in the booth with the guys, and you're talking with the guys. I'm watching how they do it. So I know I could do it. I said, "I'll tell you what. I got to make my number." It was a 6. "If I make the number, you guys shut up. Don Pinto, if I make the number, you give me the money, and I'll get you a radio show. You'll never make the number." "Oh, yeah?" Beep, bump, bump, boom, beep, bump. Guy said, "Shit, he made the 6. I said, "Dom, WCAM in Camden, they got the Spanish hour, they got the Italian hour, they got the Polish hour, they got Ricardo Moniz, they got Portia Perry, who was doing gospel." I went up, I made a deal. I said to Bud Hibbs, "I want to buy an hour's worth of time." "Oh, yeah, $125. No problem. I go to Don Pinto. I say, "I need $150. Okay? I then go to Crisconi Oldsmobile. I say to my friend John P. Crisconi, "I need $60. I'll give you a 15-minute block." I go to Fryhofer's Bread. $60. I'll give you a 15-minute block. I got 15-minute blocks. 6-4 is $200-some. Okay? Plus, I got another 25, and I'm in heaven. Okay? I do the show at the Venus Lounge, and there's a picture there. I bring Annette Funicello in and all the people that I'm doing road trips with, okay? And a young one comes on. I'm doing a talk show. Snowstorm in January closes the club, knocks the club out. Snowstorm. I'm doing record hops in South Philly at the Dixon House, playing oldies. I take my records. I go up to WCAM with the kids. We push the car out of the snow. Instead of me doing a talk show, I am doing a show from WCAM playing records. Phones are going crazy. Kids are hearing this oldie music for the first time. To them, it's brand new. Because these are songs from 1958, 56, 57, Fats, Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Phones are going crazy. I don't do an hour. I wind up doing 3 hours because there's no relief coming. I go back home. I'm sleeping. Patty calls me. She says, "You got to get on the phone. The general manager, Bud Hibbs, wants to talk to you." I said, "I'm dead tired." He said, "This is important." I get on the phone. He says, "What you do last night?" I explain what I did. He said, "Whatever you did, we never had reaction like this on any barter thing." I decided I'm going to play oldies. Went back to the club. They threw me out of the club. And so I made a deal, and I went 5 days a week on WCAM. That's how it started. Yeah. And that's it. Question over there.
It was about 3 weeks ago, I was listening to a radio show on WXPN. Ben Vaughn was playing songs exclusively by Philadelphia artists. Right. Oddly enough, one of your songs that you recorded came up.
What happened is, I told you about Dick Clark. Dick was a big fan. I was in Atlantic City, and by the way, you'll also read in the book about Sinatra and Dick Clark, which is a great story. Dick Clark wanted to go see Frank Sinatra, and I met Frank with Don Rickles. Frank used to call me Matchstick. So Dick Clark is standing in line. There's a line 2 blocks away, okay? And I said to Dick, "Meet me outside. I'll get skinny. He'll bring us in. You'll go see Frank." I can't find Dick Clark. He's 2 blocks away. I said, "What are you doing over there? Come on in." And nobody cared about, as big as he was, they didn't care about Dick Clark. They all wanted to see Sinatra. So we go through the kitchen, and Frank comes out. He's got his bow tie, and he sees me. "Matchstick, how are you? Up, up, up." He pays no attention to Dick. And I was sensitive to that. So we go, and we sit in the first row. Frank comes out, and he introduces, he was with Lionel Hampton. He introduces Leo DeRocher was in the audience, and Lorraine Day was in the audience. Does not acknowledge Dick Clark at all. At the end, you know, Dick, I see, is like really crushed, and I feel badly for him, you know. So Skinny comes over. I say to Skinny, "Give me the check." He says, "Sinatra picked up the check." So I said to Dick, "See, he really did like you after all." See? So he felt good. But Dick was the one who said to me, "Record this song." So I recorded first "Yon Teenager," "Gather Around." Then I did "Tasty." "You're So Bad." That was a hit until they heard the lyric. Okay? Yeah. Do we have enough time? Then we got to sign some. Right?
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Make
okay.
This the last question.
One of the things is, I'm from Belfast in Northern Ireland.
The who?
And there you have it. I'm from Belfast in Northern Ireland.
What was?
Ireland.
I'm an Irishman, okay? And I grew up like the Beatles.
Right.
We say, what's the capital of Ireland? Liverpool, because there's so many Irish people in Liverpool. And to me, the Beatles ruined the big beat in American music.
I agree with
you. Ruined it.
Let me say this to you. Hold it real quick. I love you. Now I got, because you were so adamant. Let me say. Okay. Let me say this. You cannot only, you have to blame radio. Yeah. This is what's wrong with radio. It wasn't only the Beatles. It became the Dave Clark Five. It became Hermits. Hermits. What happened is there was no creativity. They all hopped onto the bandwagon. And what happened is, because of the playlist, they only played 40 records. All of the English groups dominated the charts, you see. The only two groups that came through, the Four Seasons and the folks on Motown, were the only ones that survived that English invasion. So I agree, but the Beatles started it. But radio is such a bore. You know, I'm not saying this disrespectful. The problem is, when you guys were listening to radio, the stations were owned by local people who lived in the community.
That's right.
WDAS was owned by local people. So they said to their people, create programming where we can get sales, not ratings. I remember Mary Mason. I remember Louise Williams when she was the Tiger Rose Wine. Tiger Rose Wine. She then became the gospel queen. Yeah. So it's radio is bad because it's all corporate. I exist because I own my own time. Yeah. And I make my money from you people. I do not get paid from radio. I get paid from working and dancing and seeing you smile. That's the secret of America. We got to smile. Music makes you smile. When you dance, you'll never grow old. And I rest my case. This man is a tremendous. This guy is a great writer. A.D. Amorosa, stand up over here. This man is the best. He did the article, I got to tell you. Thank you. Who is that young man? But this man, I go back with, this is AD's dad. Let's have a big air for my man. Sit.
I remember you when you were an infant, okay? Your father used to bring you up on the corner. I was 18 years old when you were born. And your father used to have you in his arms, right?
Yep.
And we all admired you when you were a kid. I lived in the 1800 block of Bancroft Street.
Yeah, I was at 1906.
Right. And the house is still there.
The house, I grew up where there's only six houses, ladies and gentlemen. And everything was garages. Come on, we take a picture with my buddy.
We're leaving the house to Angela.
Thank you. You don't want to, it's terrific. All right, I guess what we got to do, sign some autograph books? Upstairs.
Books
Listen.
Are for sale upstairs.
All right. Guys, thank you. If I don't get an opportunity, thank you for the love that you've given me. Thank you.
I would have never had it.
Z was the one who said that we're doing it, but we're doing it something else.
Jeez.
Are you
going
to come upstairs?
I'll stop by, Jerry.
Please, Mike. Hi, Nancy. John, where's Linda? Linda! Did you get the book yet?
Yeah,
I want
you to sign it.
Come on, let's sign.
Okay,
we'll
go to your place.
Yeah.
Where's the moderator?
Yeah.
In the lobby. Yeah.
Yeah.
You really didn't need me. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.